Campus FM presents 100 Years of Women on Campus, produced and presented by Patricia Camilleri. Welcome to this anniversary series, remembering 100 years of women on campus. I'm Patricia Camilleri, and I shall be looking at this theme from many different angles, the sociological, the statistical, the anthropological, and the historical. I shall be asking questions about life for female students and academics on and off campus, yesterday and today, and possibly also tomorrow. I'm very pleased to have with me in the studio today Professor Sandra Dingley. Just a few words about my guest. Professor Dingley gained her PhD from Durham in 2002 in philosophy, and is now a professor at the Edwards de Bono Institute for the Design and Development of Thinking at the University of Malta. She conducts workshops and delivers lectures on creativity and innovation management, foresight, Edward de Bono thinking methods, of course, philosophy of mind, and philosophy of artificial intelligence to undergraduate and postgraduate students. Sandra set up the Institute in collaboration with Professor Edward de Bono back in October 1992. Over the years, Sandra has been instrumental in the field of creativity education in Malta. She has set up a summer school for children at the university, which based its curriculum on creativity and thinking skills. She has collaborated with the education authorities in Malta to introduce creativity and thinking skills as a subject in state schools. She has extensive experience in teaching creativity at all levels, ranging from primary school children to postgraduate university students and professionals in private and public organizations. Sandra enjoys being involved in European-funded projects on topics which range from creativity to foresight and innovation. She has organized 6 international conferences on creative thinking at the University of Malta and has edited several books and written numerous papers on her subject. Sandra enjoys the opportunities which new technology offers in today's digital world, especially when this involves networking and international collaborations. She's traveled extensively to countries which include India, Malaysia, Australia, Taiwan, the USA, Germany, the Czech Republic, and UK to conduct workshops and deliver papers at conferences. I know she enjoys traveling, so I hope we'll get a chance to talk about that as well. Welcome to you, Sandra. I'm going to call you Sandra. We've known each other a long time.
Yes, of course. Good morning, Patricia.
I think that creativity is a bit of a buzzword which rather defies definition. But can I give you the task of trying to give me one or perhaps several definitions of creativity?
Yes, of course. Creativity is not an easy word to define, and there is no one generally accepted definition of creativity. However, the way I look at it, I believe creativity always offers an element of originality. Something is different, new, at various levels. It could be locally, it could be internationally, depends on the context. So originality, surprise, because when we are faced with something which is creative, like a new product or service, there's that element of surprise, and our reaction generally is aha, so this can be done in that way. And the third element which I like to add to that is added value, because with creativity you can have creativity as a positive element, but some studies have also been done on what is called the dark side of creativity, which could also involve stuff like criminality, because I'm sure we'll all agree that criminals can be very creative, but whether that creative is something to be, well, how should we look at that? It's the dark side of creativity, and I prefer to look at the positive side of creativity myself. However, I'd also like to add that a lot of people, once they hear the word creativity, they first think of art and other related stuff. Here at the University of Malta, at the Edward de Bono Institute, we mainly deal with creativity from a more managerial aspect rather than art or any art-related topics.
Yes, in fact, I myself, if I were to think of creativity, yes, I suppose I would think immediately of the arts. But I must say, having worked here and watched the Institute grow over the years and other aspects of entrepreneurship which are promoted at the university, my mind does now tend to also turn to other aspects of creativity.
Yes, in fact, when the Institute was, I first set up the Institute way back in 1992, it first concentrated only on creativity, as in idea generation skills, and also to some extent on innovation, because the implementation of selected creative ideas then is generally called innovation, particularly in organizations. However, today the Institute has expanded and quite a few other topics are involved. We focus on four main areas. One is creativity, as in idea generation, innovation or innovation management, how is that managed strategically in organizations. Then there is foresight, which also includes future studies, and that is a relatively new topic which involves creating long-term visions and scenarios using particular methodologies, and entrepreneurship, which also includes intrapreneurship, having entrepreneurial qualities when one works in employment.
I have been involved very peripherally in foresight exercises sometimes, and I must say that I have no expertise at all in creativity, but I really did find that those exercises where you are really pushed into thinking of problem solving and how that might be done and looking to the future, I found it very challenging and very fruitful and very satisfying.
Yes, in fact, even though I said foresight is a relatively new topic, it's a relatively new topic at an academic level, because the study of the future and creating future, long-term future visions and scenarios actually goes back to the 1950s roughly. And for example, Shell, the oil company, was one of the pioneers in that region, as were the US defense authorities. I have been involved in a couple of European funded projects related to foresight, and one of the more recent ones was very interesting because we were about 30 countries involved in this project, 30 European countries, quite large, and each country had to organize two workshops, each lasting one full day, where we had to bring together 40 citizens on each occasion. And we followed a predetermined program to draw out of those citizens their hopes, their fears, their desires, their wishes for the future of Europe. Those were then all put together. They were discussed by experts. We had another meeting later on in Milano. And to cut a long story short, the final results of the project were actually presented to representatives of the European Commission in Brussels. And there was the hope, and part of it was realized, that some of them would be incorporated in new funding platforms.
That sounds like a magnificent project. A lot of countries, I mean, the EU projects I've been involved in, where there were two or three countries, were already pretty complicated, mm-hmm. let alone 30 or 40.
And the most interesting part about it was the bottom-up approach, starting from the views of citizens, their hopes, their fears, their desires for the future of Europe, because it's interesting to see what those are.
In fact, it reminds me of a book I once read. Title escapes me right now. The book was predicated on the idea that ideas can come from people within the company who you wouldn't think of asking for their ideas. And there were many examples where ideas that created better management, better finance, better, better HR actually came from not the board, but from people within in the low echelons of management in the company.
Yes, exactly. That's very, very relevant where creativity is concerned. And it brings to mind one of the many creativity gurus I've met over the years, John Edwards from Australia. He had come over to Malta for some conferences I had organized. And one of the things he often said was, why should organizations allow their employees to metaphorically hang their brains on the gate before they go into work? Because people can be very, very creative in their private lives. They build, I don't know, boats, they design gardens, they do all sorts of stuff. Why should they leave that all behind them when they go into work? Every person in any particular workplace is the best person to, how can I put this, whose brain can be utilized for ideas to make stuff more efficient, more valuable, more aesthetically pleasing. The employees within the company are the best people to utilize for that. Although today there's also a trend towards what is called open innovation. And open innovation involves sources external to the organization for ideas, including, for example, suppliers, customers, university research that gets to be published in various journals, competitors, blogs, fora. There's all sorts of places where organizations can look for new ideas, both inside the organization and outside.
Because after all, innovation is not just something to do, but it's not a luxury within a company. It's actually a sort of, you either do it or you die, I think.
Exactly. Even though this is a bit outdated, I like to give the example of when Malta joined the European Union. Those organizations that didn't adapt, that were not prepared for the changes which we knew would come along, hit that slippery slope and move towards extinction. They don't exist anymore. And the same applies today because we're living in a globalized world. Change is exponential. It's happening all the time. We cannot remain stuck in old ways of doing things. And organizations need to innovate, not just for profit or better efficiency, but also to keep up with the competition and to deal with issues that arise as a result of globalization.
Some of the things on this list that I was looking at from the website of the Institute, things that you discuss, creativity in various contexts, you've mentioned management in the workplace, and culture and creativity, leadership, in education. Certainly there's a need for creativity in methods of pedagogy, for example, I feel. And even looking at the creativity in cities, which is also an important area, and areas such as health, where perhaps things have been done in a certain way for many years, and now need to be looked at in different ways. And here you particularly mentioned mental health, which I think is getting a lot of publicity now, or people are trying to promote definitely new ideas and new approaches to mental health.
Yes, not just mental health, but in the health sector, there's also a lot of work being done, especially in what we today call the Western world, bringing in artificial intelligence into healthcare, and that certainly requires a great deal of creativity. Also, to resolve problems which can arise, even with regards to the use of personal data, which one has to be really careful about because health data is very, very sensitive. And even though there are very, very intelligent machines around, one of them, for example, was created by IBM and it's called Watson. Watson, as in the Sherlock Holmes inspector. Was he an inspector?
He was a doctor, actually.
Oh, yes, he was Dr. Watson, that's right, yes. And Watson had started off by participating in an American quiz show called Jeopardy and won against the best champions there. There are a couple of very interesting short videos on YouTube that show Watson winning these quiz games. But Watson is today being used also in healthcare. It's one of those supercomputers that learns from experience and that has countless applications. What I recently read about healthcare, creativity and artificial intelligence is related more to stuff like radiology, x-rays, CT scans, MRI scans, and having artificial intelligence do the initial diagnosis and then flag some of them for viewing by human experts. Not in Malta, mind you. I've read about this happening in other countries.
It'll come to us. Since this series is called 100 Years of Females on Campus, I would like to ask you a question about gender balance with regard to creativity. What do you feel about the Institute with regard to gender balance, and perhaps also outside academe, outside when you go to conferences or when you meet up with people in industry? How do you feel about the gender balance? How are we getting on?
Well, strangely enough, at the Institute, we are 5 female academics. So that's rather strange. We have a couple of males who are part-time casual lecturers, but otherwise the full-timers are all female. At conferences, I was very pleased when I started in this profession and started going to conferences, because the gender balance was pretty equal, roughly about 50% male, 50% female, not just the audience, but also the speakers. It was very different in those days from management conferences, because I had been to a few of those as well, and those generally consisted of men in suits, both in the audience and up on stage. Things have changed a bit today. In creativity, there's still a very good gender balance. In management, I expect there must be a lot more female representation. I mean, I don't think I'm very confident to speak about that today. But in creativity, yes. Even editors of journals, there's quite a few females. There's a very good gender balance in this area.
I think that people think about contemporary role models of creativity. One might think of Steve Jobs or Zuckerberg or someone like that, or Dyson in industry. One thinks of men. I can't think of a lot of women. They don't come to mind as great innovators in the contemporary world, but that may be because women aren't as good at promoting themselves as men are. I mean, I put that forward as a possible idea. But it's interesting that even in the early days you found that creativity did attract women.
Yes,
as well.
Yes, and it's funny you mention this, because a couple of weeks ago we had a very well-known creativity guru who happened to be in Malta, who contacted me and who came to give a session to our students. And part of his presentation consisted of him mentioning quite a large number of males and how and why they are creative. I later objected to this, as I gave him a ride back to his hotel, and he asked me to give him a list of names of females, and actually came up with a list and sent it to him of about 20 to 30 females. I wish I could refer to it right now, but there are quite a few females in top positions. Unfortunately, we often get to be presented when, you know, where businesses are concerned, and politics as well, with males. Whenever we see, for example, the group photo of European heads of states, how many women are in that photo? 2 or 3? Not very many at all. Out of how many, 28 so far? It's rather sad. There may be different motivations behind that. Sometimes I tend to think that women are not prepared to be as involved in conflictual situations as men are. However, I suppose I am one of those people who would agree with quotas for women in politics. at least at an initial stage. And I don't think it would put women in politics who are not capable of doing their job, as a lot of people who are against this may argue. I think it is just a first step to getting people, you know, putting them on the right foot to get started, and then things will take their natural course, as they have done in other countries. We don't really need to invent the wheel here in Malta. This has been done, and in Nordic countries, for example, there's quite a good gender balance.
As far as the university is concerned, the institute is important. It has quite a few students, and they produce some very interesting work, which unfortunately I don't think we're going to have time to talk about. But what about spreading the news within the university itself? What kind of action does the institute take to try and put across its own approaches to creativity within the university?
Yes, we do participate in various events. We have some which are quite large, like, for example, Global Entrepreneurship Week every November. It's no longer just 1 week, but it's a huge global event with nearly 200 countries participating. And during November every year, we organize quite a few events, both for our students, for the general public, and for other people here at university. And that does promote our work quite a lot. Then in April, there is World Creativity and Innovation Day, and we also organize quite a lot of events then. Back to what you said about dissertations, one of the most interesting dissertations I have read by one of my students, whom I must confess I also supervised, was on the future of cybercrime. And she used foresight methodologies, interviewed stakeholders, and came up with a really interesting piece of work. Perhaps it's also relevant for people who may be listening to know that all the dissertations that are produced at University of Malta are easily available from the University of Malta library. Some of them are even available online. So there's easy access to stuff, and with today's technology, search engines and whatnot, one can find lots of very, very interesting material which our students and other students here as well produce.
And I'm sure there's a great range of subjects.
Oh, definitely, definitely. At the moment, for example, I'm finishing off a review of a student, he's from Asia, on Eastern European economies and entrepreneurship and culture.
Fascinating.
Very interesting topic.
Look forward to reading that one. What about your own journey, Sandra, into academe, because you worked before you went to university and then went to university and then ended up doing a PhD in philosophy, and so your journey has been a very innovative, if I dare say that, way of approaching sort of a career line.
It hasn't been an easy journey. I finished school age 16. My dad wanted us girls to become telex operators. Most people today don't even know what a telex is. They don't exist anymore, as far as I'm aware. I started studying towards the end of my 20s, early 30s, always part-time evening. I started with my A-levels because I wasn't sure whether I was up to really studying seriously or not. I got very good results. I was happy about that. And there was then the opportunity to join university for an evening part-time course. It was really on a year-to-year basis. It wasn't initially a degree program, but it did eventually turn into a degree program. It was at the time when there was no Faculty of Arts at university, but things happened nevertheless. You know, they found loopholes and started teaching topics related to the arts in the evening. That went on, and I actually see myself a bit like an ant building a molehill, well, a molehill, an anthill, with nobody really noticing, but taking things more on a day-to-day basis, never looking too far at the long term while I was studying, at least, because that would feel rather daunting. But, you know, bachelor's, honours, master's, and PhD, and I finally got there, because when I finished school at 16, as I mentioned before, very few females had the opportunity to continue their studies.
I asked you this question really because I think that it's important for listeners to hear stories about people who, you know, have really, really decided a bit late in life to go for tertiary education, as I did myself. I was a mature student, so were you. But I have heard that the various lecturers in these programs have said that they do enjoy very much having mature students in their classrooms.
Yes, and I have a couple of anecdotes, one which I can quickly relate. There was one semester when I was fortunate enough to visit University of St. Andrews in Scotland. I think I must have been about 40 years old at the time, and most of the students in St. Andrews were aged roughly between 18 and 25. As a 40-year-old, I got to be invited to 21-year-old birthday parties, which was really good fun. I was even taken, so to speak, to the Students' Union one Friday night, and it was quite an eye-opener. But at times I also felt I had to take the trip from St. Andrews to Edinburgh to see people my age and a bit more normality, not that atmosphere where practically everyone is much, much younger than me and has a sort of a different way of life. But I must admit it was really good fun.
I really wanted to ask you about your travels, because that's what you're really concentrating on now in your spare time. So where have you been lately, just quickly before we finish?
Yes, Ethiopia, Oman, camping in the middle of the desert, Jordan, Tunisia, quite a few other places as well, Mexico. I love travelling.
It's very my courageous, but very interesting.
I encourage anyone who has the possibility to travel to do so, because it's a true mind opener, helps one to understand so much more about the world we're living in and other cultures, and it makes one more responsible and more mature.
Well, Professor Sandra Dingley, thank you very, very much for being with us today. I've really enjoyed talking to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for the invitation and for having me here today. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to 100 Years of Women on Campus. If you would like to hear the programs again, just go to www.maltauniversitybroadcasting.com and click on webcasts. Join me again next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye. You have just listened to 100 Years of Women on Campus, produced and presented by Patricia Camilleri.